here. His probe of Titan has gone rogue, and he cannot even locate it, she thought. Now Eberle refuses to help him, and he fears that his career will collapse around his ears. My poor darling, to come this far, and then fail. He's had a taste of success, and now his fall will be deeper and more humiliating because of it. She pushed her chair back, brushed his hands away from the poorly knotted ascot, and retied it for him. Urbain pecked her on the cheek by way of thanks, and left for his office and another day of frustration, of edging closer to the brink of disaster. Jean-Marie stood there in her kitchen for a long time, alone, wondering what she could do to help her husband.
Holly intercepted Eberle as he walked toward the administration building at the crest of the low hill on which the village of Athens had been built. He knew it was no accidental meeting. "Good morning," he said cheerfully. "Aren't they all?" Holly replied as she fell into step alongside him. "Yes. I suppose we tend to take our perfect weather for granted." Holly reached out and tugged at the sleeve of his tunic, stopping him. "Look around, Malcolm. Look at this place. I mean, really look at it." Puzzled, Eberle swept his gaze across the carefully landscaped scenery, green and lush and flowering. The clean white buildings, the glittering lake. "It's really wonderful, isn't it?" he murmured. "What's missing?" Holly asked. From the set of her square jaw, Eberle could see that Holly had a specific point to make. "What's missing, Malcolm?" she asked again. "Rain," he replied lightly. "Snow, fog, sleet." "Don't try to make a joke of it," she insisted. "All right, you tell me what's missing from this demi-paradise, this other Eden, this..." "Kids," Holly snapped. "Children. We have no children here." "Oh, that." "Yes, that," said Holly. "You've got to face up to it, Malcolm. You've got to do something about the ZPG rule." "I'm thinking about it," he muttered grudgingly. "Think harder, then, and faster. The deadline for registering candidates is next Monday. ZPG could be a major issue." "Only if someone makes an issue out of it," Eberle answered testily. "Somebody's bound to." "They would need a petition signed by 2/3 of the citizens to repeal the zero-growth protocol," he pointed out. Holly's lips curved into a knowing smile. "You looked up the regulations, huh?" "So did I." "I doubt that anyone in this habitat has the inclination to mount a petition drive. They're all too apathetic." With a slight shake of her head, Holly replied, "Don't underestimate the people, Malcolm, especially the women." Feeling uncomfortable, Eberle decided to shift the focus of their conversation. "Speaking of issues, how do you feel about mining ice from the rings of Saturn?" Holly made a small shrug. "Nadia Wunderly's dead set against it, and so are the rest of the scientists. But they're less than a tenth of this community's population. If you make an issue of it, the scientists will put up a candidate to run against you. Wouldn't you prefer to run unopposed?" "Unopposed?" The idea hadn't occurred to Eberle. He'd assumed that someone would come up to run against him, and maybe more than one candidate. He actually preferred to have several candidates running that would split the votes against him, while as the incumbent he could count on a solid block, especially if he started to put the ice mining plan into operation. "Naturally, I prefer to run unopposed, but I doubt that things will work out that way." "As a matter of fact," Holly said, a slow grin creeping across her face, "the Constitution requires an opposition candidate. I checked." He looked at her with newfound appreciation. "You've been checking a lot of things, haven't you?" "Part of my job," Holly said. "If nobody volunteers to run against you, a candidate has to be selected at random by the personnel computer." "Which is run by your human resources department," Eberle said.
"Right."
"Which means that you, Holly, can select my opponent."
"Not me. The computer."
"You," Eberle said, pointing an index finger at her like a pistol.
"Then I'll have to find somebody who'll bring up the ZPG issue."
Eberle scowled darkly at her.
8 January, 2096. Noon. Nadia Wunderlich sealed the outer hatch of the Nanolab's airlock entrance and fidgeted impatiently for the few seconds that it took for the inner door to pop open. When it did, Raul Tavallera swung the heavy hatch open for her. "Why, thank you, Raul," she said, a smile dimpling her face. "Have you been standing there long, waiting for me?" Puzzled by her attempt at humor, Tavallero replied, "I'm heading out for lunch." Then he added, "With Holly." And his face brightened a little. He went into the airlock as Wunderlich stepped into the lab. "Chris is talking with that Russian from maintenance, Timoshenko," Tavallero said, as he pulled the airlock hatch shut. Wunderlich passed benches loaded with silent equipment as she walked deeper into the laboratory. She heard Cardenas's voice and the gruff lower tones of the Russian engineer. She was still losing weight, and now that New Year's had come and gone, she was wondering when she should have Cardenas flush the nanomachines out of her body. Cardenas was perched on her tall stool, as usual, with a starched white smock over her dress. Timoshenko stood next to her, a stubby, thick-set figure in gray coveralls, several centimeters shorter than the seated Cardenas. "We could do more than armor the superconducting wires," she was saying. "We could develop nanomachines to automatically repair any damage done to them."
"That's not as easy as you might suppose," Timoshenko said. "Very powerful electrical currents flow through those wires."
Cardenas nodded. "Well, if you can give me the specifics, I can try to work out a program for self-repair. Then we can test it here in the lab on short samples of superconductor before we install any nanos on the shielding wires themselves." Timoshenko started to reply, then noticed Wunderlich standing off at some distance.
"Ah," he said to Cardenas, "you have company."
"Come on over, Nadia," Cardenas called to Wunderlich. Turning back to Timoshenko, she explained, "Nadia and I have a lunch date. Care to join us? We can continue our discussion in the cafeteria." Timoshenko dipped his chin in agreement while Wunderlich thought to herself, "He's the guy who piloted the transfer craft that carried Gaeta to the rings and then picked him up afterward. If he did that for Manny, he can do it for me. Maybe." All through lunch in the busy, clattering cafeteria, Timoshenko and Cardenas talked about using nanomachines to protect and even repair the superconducting wires that provided the magnetic field which protected the habitat from radiation. Wunderlich had no chance to ask Cardenas about flushing the nanos inside her. She listened to their conversation with only a fraction of her attention. Her mind focused on flying out to the rings again, this time to pick up samples and prove to those doubting earthworm flatlanders back home that the ring harbored living psychrophiles, organisms that lived within the ice particles of Saturn's rings. "How can they not believe it?" Wunderlich asked herself as she munched on a fruit salad straight from the habitat's orchards. "They know that amino acids and other complex polypeptides form naturally in amorphous ice particles. They've seen it in comets for damn near a century. Why shouldn't the next step be believable? Amino acids self-assemble into proteins, and proteins evolve into living organisms. It's happened in liquid water on half a dozen worlds that we know of, and in liquid sulfur on Venus, for Christ's sakes. It just goes slower at freezing temperatures. Amorphous ice allows chemicals to flow as if they were in a liquid, but it all happens at a slower pace. Unless you've got some catalyst present, like an antifreeze. I wonder if that's what happens in the ring particles. Plenty of energy available from Saturn's magnetic field and the electrical flux of the rings themselves." "Nadia, did you hear me?" She abruptly realized that Cardenas was talking to her, the expression on her face somewhere between worried and annoyed.
"I'm sorry, Chris. My mind wandered."
"Back to the rings, I suppose," Cardenas said, an understanding smile curving her lips.
"Where else?" Wunderlich replied. Timoshenko asked, "Do you really believe that those particles are truly alive?"
"Yes, of course. How else do you explain the fact that Saturn's rings are so big and bright? Those creatures maintain the rings for their own survival, just as living organisms maintain